From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. If you follow the U.S. Supreme Court and constitutional law, you've likely heard of originalism. We'll chat with the author of a new book designed to explain the concept. The American economy could benefit from more people taking apprenticeships. That's the thinking behind a new grant for NC State University. You'll learn about it. The COVID-19 coronavirus is likely to have a lingering economic impact. Top economist from NC State offers his early assessment of key issues. The coronavirus has prompted political parties and candidates to throw out their plans. We'll explore the pandemic's potential impact on election 2020. And speaking of COVID-19, it's also affecting lives in other ways. Donna Martinez addresses one of them in the Carolina Journal headline.
The coronavirus pandemic is wreaking havoc on life as we know it. In response, John Locke Foundation researchers have produced a series of policy briefs. They contain specific recommendations for North Carolina policymakers, all with an eye toward quickly and prudently securing the health and safety of every North Carolinian, as well as the vitality of our economy. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now with a look at some of those policy recommendations. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's a scary time in a lot of different ways. We have a public health crisis that has hit our country. And here in North Carolina, we are reacting, and the John Locke Foundation is leading. Tell us about the goals of this series of recommendations.
Well, the goal is to provide a list of policy recommendations and context that the state could use to respond to this this pandemic in a way that ensures that we get through it in the best possible manner. And this is looking at five different areas using our in-house policy expertise to look at some of the different areas where state policy can intervene and make it easier for North Carolinians to receive health care, for North Carolina's children to be educated, for us to be able to use the state budget in ways that can help regular North Carolinians get through this, and to make sure that our workforce remains in its best possible status through this time.
It's really interesting, the details in these reports, which, by the way, are posted at johnlock.org. Very valuable, interesting information. Terry, it seems to me that the briefs really cover two types of information. One is a lot of barriers and rules and regulations and things that really are keeping people from being able to earn a living in an easier way, also keeping us from having access to the full group of medical professionals who have skills that we need right now. So there's that type of recommendation. But also then when it comes to the issue of finances, thankfully, North Carolina is in a very good shape in terms of our fiscal decisions of the last several years. Talk a little bit, if you could, about those two major areas.
Sure. I'll hit on the finances first, because this is what a lot of people don't know, is just how good the finances are on the state level. Now, we know that there are huge deficits at the federal level. We know that at the federal level, they'll struggle to be able to put together a package that's going to really be effective for all Americans. And if they do, it's going to add to our already astounding deficit. In North Carolina, we have huge billion-dollar surpluses. In fact, we have at our disposal right now over $3 billion available for whatever lawmakers decide is needed. And this may come in the form of refunds or some sort of payment to North Carolinians to help them get through this time. This may come to support aid and any other programs that may be necessary. You know, we don't know exactly how long this is going to last. We don't know how much the state is going to be affected by this financially. We know, we suspect that there's going to be some sort of recession coming out of this. It's good to know that North Carolina's lawmakers have been prudent in the way that they've dealt with taxpayer funds and are ready for any sort of recession or downturn in the economy that may come our way.
Again, all of these recommendations are available online at johnlock.org on this range of different policy areas, very specific recommendations and details that state lawmakers can use when they are crafting a response to what's going on in our state. Now, Terry, of course, you are not only Vice President for Research, but you are the Director of Education Studies. That's your area of particular expertise. And it's a huge area that's been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. We've got kids who are now getting their schooling online. And that has brought up a lot of interesting discussion about the opportunity that that affords us, but also the challenges. So what do you make of online education?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of question about just how much education we can do online as a state. Now, North Carolina has a virtual, two virtual charter schools and a virtual public school. The virtual public school offers courses online mostly to high school students, while our virtual charter schools provide education to around 5,000 North Carolina students on a full-time basis. And so we have some infrastructure right now that can help us with some of the online learning that needs to occur. But the reality is that we have to think about some very serious issues. First of all, the availability of broadband and devices. We know that broadband availability and internet-ready and internet accessible devices are not evenly distributed across students in the state. Low-income students might not have access to these things, therefore it inhibits their ability to learn online. But a more important concern is what to do about those students that have disabilities, the special needs students, who through federal law are required to receive services through their school and how that would square with online learning. Obviously, if they're not in the school building, special needs students can't receive the services that they're legally required to receive. And so the question is, how do we conduct online learning without running afoul of federal special education law? And I think that's one of the more serious considerations that I know that the federal and state government is looking at right now, is to ensure that everyone receives a education online that is equitable and meets their needs.
Terry, is it an easy transition to take curriculum from a bricks and mortar in-person environment to an online environment? And are teachers prepared to do that?
Some are prepared to do that, but many are not. And I think that a lot of times when we talk about online education, we underestimate the teachers that spend their time online and provide online education, whether it be through the virtual charter schools or the virtual public school, is that it's a very unique delivery system for instruction. And it's not always easy to be able to take what happens in a classroom and just put it online. So there's an adjustment that needs to be made. It's not an easy adjustment for a lot of teachers, and it varies by grade and by subject. We could imagine that a teacher teaching math, for example, would have a much easier time putting things online and having students complete assignments than maybe teachers in other areas would have, say English, for example. So we know that there's a great deal of variability in how this is going to be conducted.
Terry, looking long term, do we have any sense at this point of what this could mean? Will kids be able to be tested? Will they be able to be promoted to the next grade, to graduate? Do we have any idea?
We are receiving guidance from the federal and state education agency as we speak, so it's not clear right now. We know that the testing, for example, may be canceled. That would require a waiver from the federal government in order to do so. We have a school calendar law that requires 185 days or 1,025 hours. We don't know whether schools are going to be able to complete that requirement. And so if it looks like they won't be able to do so, then lawmakers will need to step in and waive that requirement as well. A lot of moving parts here, a lot of regulations that have to be interpreted.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you follow the Supreme Court and constitutional law, you've probably heard about the concept of originalism. What's it all about? Where can you find a good introduction to it? Professor Ilan Werman of Arizona State University has an answer. It's his book, A Debt Against the Living. So why did you write this introduction to originalism?
Well, the short answer is there wasn't a book like this. So the first question really is, why isn't originalism, this idea that we should interpret the Constitution according to its original meaning, right? The way its words would have been understood by the framers who wrote it and the public that ratified it. That's what this originalism is. Why isn't it taught more in the law schools? I mean, it's kind of surprising, right? We have federal judges who are originalists. Probably more than half the Supreme Court at the moment is originalist, and so much of the public, I think, considers themselves to be originalists, or they understand intuitively that we should care what the framers said and so on, but it's not taught in the law schools. And there are reasons for that, and we could go into that, but so as a student, as a law student, I had to research this on my own. I had to look into it on my own. I had heard about this originalism thing. It made sense to me. And so I had to strike it out on my own. I didn't find an introduction. I looked for one. I couldn't find one. I had to read all of these very interesting books on particular theories of originalism and so on, but there was no one single volume, short narrative introduction to originalism. It's an introduction to and defense of originalism and the founding. So I have done all the work for you in this short book. So if you want an introduction, there wasn't one before, and now there is one. So that's why I thought I had to do it.
You mentioned the founding. How important is the American founding to originalism?
There are different kinds of defenses of originalism, many of which don't talk about the founding. I think that's wrong. I think a complete defense of originalism requires also a defense of the founding. The way the argument of my book works, it's sort of a two-step argument, right? The first question is, look, how do we interpret law in our legal system, right? Ordinarily, we first figure out, what does this law actually say? What does it mean? What does it do, right? Whether it's a contract or a statute or a treaty or a constitution. And then there's the question of, okay, well, are we bound by that law? Are we bound to this contract? We're bound even by Congress's bad laws, right? So the question is, we interpret legal texts, I argue, right? The way we interpret any communication intended as a public instruction, right? With its original public meaning, right? Not a secret meaning, right? Not, otherwise, it'd be a pretty ineffective instruction. That's how we interpret these documents. But that doesn't answer the question of, well, should we be bound by that document at all? Someone might say, well, okay, fine. I get that the original meaning of the Constitution is X, Y, and Z, but we don't care. We don't want to be bound by what a bunch of long since dead white men wrote. So to fully defend originalism, you have to argue that the Constitution is binding law, the same way that the laws of Congress are binding, such that we should care what it says and we should follow its original meaning. Because the best non-originalist will say we're okay with judges updating the meaning and content of the Constitution over time. And so be it. You know, they're even okay distinguishing the Constitution from ordinary laws, right? The Constitution's different. It's old and it's hard to change. That's the premise, right? So to fully defend originalism, I think the originalist has to defend the binding nature of the Constitution. And that requires a defense of the founding. And my claim is the Constitution is binding if it successfully balances self-government and liberty.
We're chatting with Professor Ilan Werman of Arizona State University. He's author of the book, A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism. Why should we care about either originalism or the founding? Why not just say majority rules?
In a free society like ours, we don't just care about what a majority of the people want. Right? Why do we have constitutions? What does a constitution for a free society have to accomplish? And the answer is two things. It has to successfully create a regime of self-government. This is what you were getting at. A regime by which we the people can choose who we want to be and govern ourselves and decide who we want to be politically, morally, socially, culturally, economically, what have you. But at the same time, this exact same document, this exact same piece of paper also has to preserve a large measure of liberty, of natural liberty. Otherwise, why would we get out of the state of nature into this thing called civil society if we got a raw deal, if we gave up too much of that freedom we had in the state of nature? We would never leave the state of nature. So a free constitution has to balance these two things, self-government and liberty. And I say balance, why? Because these objectives are in tension with each other, right? It's often popular majorities that infringe on the rights of minorities. So writing a constitution that successfully balances these competing objectives is no easy task. And I argue that the framers were remarkably successful at achieving a balance between self-government and liberty, such that the Constitution is legitimate and binding today, even if it's imperfect, right? I mean, here's the point, right? This is the key takeaway. Something must make a Constitution binding. It can't be that no Constitution is ever binding. Society would fall apart. That can't be right. But it also can't be the case that a Constitution is only binding if it says exactly what you personally would want it to say. That's also crazy. 300 million Americans might have a different opinion about that. There must be some middle ground, something that makes a constitution legitimate and therefore binding, even if you think it's imperfect in certain provisions or particulars. My claim is the constitution is legitimate and binding in this sense if it meets this threshold balancing of self-government and liberty, these two objectives of a free society, even if you would do things a bit differently on either side of the equation.
All your research suggests to you that this Constitution and originalism are pretty good?
Today, we have all of these movements to, well, we need to change the Constitution, right? Why do we care about what a bunch of dead white men said? But the Constitution is insufficiently democratic, they might say, right? Here's what's so crazy and insidious about this. The people who want to change the Constitution, who think the Constitution is bad, some bad document, they say two things. They say it's insufficiently democratic. We need better democracy. We need to get rid of the equal representation in the Senate. We need to get rid of the Electoral College, right? It's insufficiently democratic. But at the same time, these same people want to make sure that democratic majorities can't do certain things, right? You can't decide on moral issues like abortion or gay marriage. So we want better democracy, but only if it leads to progressive results. I mean, that's crazy. That's typically the approach here. And as I was reading about the founders and their political philosophy, it turns out that when you have these objectives, right? First of all, it was itself an incredible achievement to say, we want self-government and we want liberty and it requires a balance, right? Republican remedies for the diseases most incident to Republican government, as Madison says in Federalist 10. Simply stating this objective and the understanding that they're in tension with each other, these two objectives, is itself an innovation, and we're indebted to them for that. And then they did a pretty darn good job of striking this balance, a pretty amazing job through ingenious mechanisms that were novel, at the time. Separation of powers, checks and balances, the enumeration of power, and this division of federal-state power. The representative mechanism itself was a novelty at the time. And of course, the provisions in the Bill of Rights were also a novelty. But more than that, what's so great about the Constitution of our founders is they wrote it in such a way that it would continue to strike a successful balance between self-government and liberty long into the future. On both sides of this equation, right? Look at the liberty side of the equation. The rights-protecting provisions of the Constitution are written in sufficiently broad terms to be applicable to changing circumstances. Why do you think the First Amendment applies to the speech made on the internet? Why do you think the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable searches and seizures, right, applies to GPS devices that police officers put on cars, right? Many things the founders couldn't have conceived of.
The book is A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism. The author is Professor Ilan Werman of Arizona State University. He spoke recently in Durham and Raleigh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. There's an ongoing debate in higher education. How many people should go to college? Do all of them really need four-year degrees? Are there other ways to get people the skills they need for good long-term careers? Critics of the College for All crowd cite several alternatives. The U.S. Labor Department is focusing attention on one of them. During a recent visit to North Carolina, Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia touted new programs involving apprenticeships.
Apprenticeships are paid positions that combine on-the-job training and mentorship with classroom instruction, and which result at the end in a credential that's recognized by other employers in the industry.
Although apprenticeships don't have to involve higher education, Scalia made his announcement on the campus of NC State University.
Today, we're taking another important step to expand apprenticeships. The Department of Labor is awarding nearly $100 million to 28 public-private partnership programs across the United States. These grants aim to expand apprenticeships into industries that don't have large-scale apprenticeship programs currently. These fields include advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and healthcare. We want to help prepare American workers to fill these jobs. I'm particularly pleased then to announce that NC State will receive one of the grants the department is awarding today, a $6 million Closing the Skills Gap grant to create a new apprenticeship program in artificial intelligence. The NC State program will be called Artificial Intelligence Academy, North Carolina's Apprenticeships for Innovation. With the grant funds, NC State will offer apprenticeships that include both a classroom component and an on-the-job training component at IT companies that include IBM and Citrix. The apprenticeships will typically be around 20 to 40 weeks in length. The university and its partners in the private sector intend to prepare 5,000 apprentices for careers in up to 21 different artificial intelligence occupations. The $6 million grant we're awarding to NC State today is among the largest we're making, and it will be matched with an additional $2.7 million in private sector funding. So, congratulations.
That's U.S. Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia. He's discussing the Labor Department's increased focus on apprenticeships. That includes a $6 million grant to NC State University. It's designed to boost apprenticeships in the field of artificial intelligence. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. How might the coronavirus pandemic affect North Carolina's economy in the long run? Professor Michael Walden of North Carolina State University addressed that question in a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation.
We're probably headed for a recession. We may actually be in a recession. We won't know that for several months. Clearly, this is something that's been unexpected, and it's created fear among households and businesses. We have countries around the world that are in relative lockdown. New York City is pretty much in a lockdown. So when people can't get out and maybe go to their jobs, they can't go to restaurants and spend money, they can't go to events, that's going to have a negative impact on the economy.
Walden says the news isn't all bad.
If there's good news here, it is that going into this crisis, the economy was in good shape. We had very good job numbers, for example, in February. We were growing at about between a 2 and 2.5% rate, which is good. Wages were going up. People were feeling good enough that they were starting to look for other jobs. Paid more. All that's good. So when we come out of this at the other side, hopefully we can pick up where we left off. So I view this as temporary. I don't view this as suggesting anything long-term, a long-term decline. And hopefully we'll learn some things about how to deal with viruses. I don't know that medical people can say with any certainty we won't ever have this happen again.
Walden says some businesses are likely to rethink some basic elements of their operations.
It's probably going to cause some businesses to rethink their supply chain. That simply means where does a business get their inputs? And because we've seen those businesses that have deep supply chains, particularly in Asia, particularly in China, really hurt by this. And I would expect to see some revaluation of that, to have at least a backup supply chain or more maybe a complementary supply chain here in the country. I think the president's emphasis on, for example, rebuilding manufacturing in this country, I think that probably will get further looks at and perhaps further support, because I think we're beginning to see in this crisis some of the downsides of globalization in terms of our linkages with other countries. And when those other countries falter, we can be impacted.
Walden says the coronavirus presents a new economic challenge.
We're really in unknown territory here. I'm 69 years old. I've never seen the country and so many sectors of the country actually shut down. So this is totally new to us and how we deal with it. So a little bit, I guess, when there are critics who say, well, the government's not handling this right, et cetera, well, I sort of say, gosh, we don't have a playbook for how to handle this. And I think you didn't want, or at least I wouldn't have wanted public officials to early on say, oh, this is going to be horrible and create fear, when maybe it wasn't going to be horrible, but now we know it is. So I think there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking here in terms of criticism policy.
That's NC State University economist Michael Walden speaking recently to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Walden says policymakers will face some important questions.
How deep into policy do we want to go? That is, clearly the federal government is providing support for test kits and some other health health articles. But do we want to go into paying for people's sick leave? Do we want to go into I think President Obama's chief economic advisor, Jason Furman, said we should send a $1,000 check to every person in the country. That would be about $360 billion. The president has recommended payroll taxes not be collected for the rest of the year. That would be a bill of about $1 trillion. So I think one of the questions right now is, up to now, what I think Congress and the president will likely pass, many people can get behind. But when we go deeper into this, I think there are going to be some questions. This is not like the Great Recession, where it was an economic collapse, and where, whether you like it or not, the federal government engaged in typical cyclical response, where you provide money so that consumers can go out and buy. Again, I think we're in unknown territory medically. I think we're in unknown territory in terms of economic policy also.
Which economic sectors are likely to feel the biggest hit from the coronavirus?
Manufacturing. We have manufacturers here, particularly in electronics and technology, that have ties to China. And hopefully China is getting back on their feet, but some of the damage has already been done. And then our farmers. North Carolina farmers have just been hard hit over the last really 2 or 3 years. Low prices, and then on top of that, trade war, and they were targeted, if you will, by China in terms of China not buying them. And then we had optimism in February when the so-called Phase One trade deal with China was announced by the administration and signed. And as part of that deal, China agreed to buy billions and billions of additional farm products. And that would have benefited North Carolina farmers. Now, I think there's a concern that's not going to happen, or certainly not going to happen on the original schedule. So I think our farmers are going to be further impacted by that. But now, of course, as this virus has continued and the steps taken to combat it, I mean, if you're in the restaurant business, you're going to be hurt. If you're in the hotel business, you're going to be hurt dramatically. If you're in the travel business, you're going to be hurt. Tourism, North Carolina has a big tourist industry. That's probably going to be hurt as we move into the spring and summer. So a lot of industries are going to feel the effects of this. That's why it's probably going to mean an official recession, because recessions have to be broad-based. They're not just a downturn due to one industry having a problem. They're broad-based.
Walden ponders the prospects for regulatory reform linked to the coronavirus pandemic.
This is another learning situation. Hopefully those rules and regs regarding testing and regarding the response, the ability of the government to respond to something, a health crisis like this. Hopefully those will be reviewed. And because, we really haven't had anything on this scale. And the last major outbreak, at least that I'm aware of, was SARS in 2003. We've had some other outbreaks, but they've been very minor and very relatively small. So hopefully this will cause us to review those kind of rules so that we can have the next time, and there probably will be a next time, a more rapid response.
Which economic numbers should we watch?
In terms of economic data, I think the job market is going to be key. I would not be surprised to see a next job report show a reduction in jobs and a slight increase in the unemployment rate. I'm not looking for anything dramatic like unemployment going up to double digits, but we're at 3.5%. I could see that go up to maybe high threes, maybe 4%. And then we'll want to look for whether that starts to decline. And then you get an initial reaction, indication of that by looking at the initial claims for unemployment, which are probably going to rise. And then so I will look and see if those are coming down. So those are all standard things that economists look at. But we're probably a couple months away from seeing a turn in the corner here.
Some proposals for addressing the economic hit involve lots of new government spending. Walden addresses the potential downside.
There is research that suggests that as the debt rises as a percent of GDP, one of the hidden costs that people don't see is that has an impact on slowing economic growth. The more that we go into debt publicly, the less the private sector economy grows, which means down the road that's less wealth generating the economy and less jobs.
That's Professor Michael Walden, economist at NC State University. He's discussing potential long-term economic impacts linked to the coronavirus pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. With the coronavirus dominating world, U.S., and state news, it's easy to forget that we are only about 7 months or so away from the 2020 presidential election. What will this public health challenge mean to politics? Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins us now to talk about the political implications of what we're all experiencing. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
We have seen the state of Ohio postpone its presidential primary. Is it chaos or really organized chaos as each state tries to figure out what to do?
Well, each state's going to do what its leaders think are best for that state. There are a number of people across the political perspective who are somewhat troubled with Ohio's decision to do that, because essentially there's a very stringent set of rules for when elections are to take place. For primaries, states set that. But for general elections in federal years, Congress sets that. And there are rules involving things like absentee ballots and military voters and that sort of thing, which are federal laws. And so there's some concern that if other states start doing that, then it could cause some problems, some constitutional issues that nobody wants to actually hash out right now. I mean, they'd rather keep people safe. So there's that angle to it. Probably the fortunate thing for all, at least on the federal level, is that it's pretty clear that the two presidential nominees from the major parties are settled. It's going to be Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I mean, that's, you know, there's not much doubt about that. But you have an awful lot of states where you have primaries for races from, you know, the lowest level of municipal government all the way up to U.S. Senate. And so that's going to cause some concerns.
Are we going to see a push for voting by mail? Washington State already does this.
Yeah.
Is that the future?
That's one thing that we're going to see a lot more of. I think we may well see some sort of push for secure online voting. I'm not sure it can be done, but we're going to see. We've had people talk about that before. I think even Ross Perot talked about doing things like that. And that was, what, 25 plus years ago. So I think if those people who have been concerned about the security of things like early voting and no consequence absentee balloting and all that stuff, I've kind of just been steamrolled by events right now. And so I think those sorts of options, perhaps extending periods of early voting and things like that, we may well see that at least for this election cycle.
It's been interesting to watch the national media coverage of the president and his administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic, and separate from the issue of public health and all the decisions that are being there made regarding that. Let's talk about the politics of it. He is being praised by some and panned by others. What does this mean for his reelection?
Well, he stumbled into this very badly initially. He didn't take it very seriously. He said it was going to be over with there were going to be 15 cases in the U.S. and they were going to go away. He was appearing at news conferences without his top public health officials initially. And for whatever reason, I think some people say Tucker Carlson, but anyway, flipped and said, wait a minute, this is a problem. But then you suddenly started to see him take a completely different tone, be very, very serious about it. And notwithstanding what he said or when he said or whatever, he has certainly been deferring more and more to people who have specific expertise about these sorts of things. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the head of,
National Institutes of Health.
Yeah, he's the basically the infectious disease expert of,
right.
among
the
all.
The top doc, so to speak, other than the Surgeon General.
Right, and maybe now his position may actually be more important than the Surgeon General's in a lot of ways. But he has certainly stepped up and been given the message of take this seriously, but don't panic. I think somebody else at the North Carolina but federal level who has really stepped up in a big way is Greg Murphy, who's the congressman from the 3rd District. He was the only MD in the General Assembly when he was there. He won the seat that used to be held by Walter Jones Jr. And he has been very active on social media, again, saying, listen, take these things seriously. Do these precautions. Wash your hands. You know, practice social distancing. This is going to be something that's going to be really difficult for a period of a few weeks. But if we handle this right, then it will subside. If we don't handle this right, then we've got possibly months of complete disruption.
We've heard a lot about the flattening of the curve,
right.
so to speak,
right.
trying to make sure that we don't have a steep, steep increase in diagnoses, essentially creating the bell that other countries have seen. We want ours to be flat. Okay, so that's the Trump position. What about Joe Biden as the presumptive Democratic nominee? Has all the air been sucked out of the room for him, or is he kind of raising his profile as part of this?
He did some things right before the second Super Tuesday, if you will, where he mentioned that he had convened a panel of experts, all respected medical and public health officials, and started talking about his own plans for dealing with the virus. I don't think that if you look at the way things stand as of the time we're recording and the vice president's plans, that the president's and former vice president's plans are really all that different. But he did sort of step forward a little bit before the president did on this. So I think right now people are essentially perceiving both of them on a par. The vice president sometimes presents a more calming presence. Other times, because of his verbal flubs, a less calming presence. And so, this is something that no one has dealt with probably since, you know, in a century, as far as this is concerned. And we're, of course, a much more interconnected society and a much larger population than we had when the 1918 flu pandemic hit. So this is just something that's completely new, and some people are stepping up seemingly better than others about this.
And we'll have to wait and see if there is a political impact at all for either one of those candidates. Let's move to the North Carolina governor's race, because it's gotten pretty interesting here. Of course, we have Democrat Roy Cooper, who is the incumbent, and he has been, along with his public health officials, really leading the charge here, reacting here in North Carolina. One of the things that he did a few days ago was to issue that executive order about no dining in at restaurants in North Carolina. You could still do delivery or takeout.
Right.
The current Lieutenant Governor, Dan Forrest, who is also the Republican Party's nominee, challenging Roy Cooper for the top job, reacted to that. Tell us about it.
Lieutenant Governor Forrest said correctly that the executive order that the governor issued was based on a state statute which gives him certain emergency powers, and that that executive order had to be approved by a majority of the members of the Council of State. Those are the statewide elected executive branch officials. And it wasn't. We know at least six of the 11 voted against it, potentially seven. We don't know what, at this time, we don't know what State Auditor Beth Wood did. But they voted against the portion of it, not the portion of it dealing with providing additional benefits and things like that, scraping away the unemployment regulations and the like, unemployment insurance regulations. The part dealing with the restaurant closures and the banning of all large gatherings. And the argument they made, which is legally a correct one, is that it was not approved properly. And the other argument that they initially made and then kind of walked away from when they got some pushback was that perhaps it's possible that we could have a separate set of rules for large cities and urban and suburban areas and the more rural parts of the state, where the effective house arrest of everyone doesn't make any sense at all, where there are no large gatherings. I mean, why are you banning restaurants in very lightly populated areas? And why can't we have different sets of rules for different circumstances? It's going to be politically very, very difficult thing for Dan Forrest to win. But I think you may be right on the law.
And of course, Carolina Journal is following every development of this situation, available online at carolinajournal.com. Also on Twitter at Carolina Journal. Rick Henderson is editor in chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Thank you for joining us. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.